Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, I am joined by Sholin Boyson. Sholin, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Nick, and yourself?
I am doing not too bad at all. And of course, we are also joined today by Mr. Herman Fritores. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I'm well, thanks.
Good, good, good. So regular listeners of the show will know that I was complaining about not having a topic to write on for my occasional column, the dailyfriend.co.za. And so I resorted to an old man rant about how there are too many new things. So you can check that out on dailyfriend.co.za if you're interested. So, of course, today our show is once again brought to us by a sponsor. Our sponsor is still Bitvice. Here's some words from them. Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should own their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. Right. So we should probably get into the show now. It is a Thursday today, but it does feel to me a little bit spiritually Friday-ish. So anyway, I have... Maybe it's just been a long week. So we had a discussion about this in an internal meeting this morning about some of the meaning of this, but I'm just going to lay out the story for you here. So Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan has asked Trade Union Solidarity to provide a list of people with the necessary technical skills to help government address the skills crisis at Eskom. On the 14th of July, Gordhan wrote to the Managing Director of Solidarity to thank them for their offer in May this year to mobilize crucial skills. And basically, he said the following: due to the urgency of assistance required from Eskom, can you kindly provide the list of names for engineers and technical experts that can be deployed to Eskom to address the generation performance challenges facing the company? So he was responding to a letter written by Afroforum in May of this year.
Solidarity,
who said that they had all these professionals who were willing to get involved with Eskom to help it out. I think we even covered on the show, actually. So, Sholin, let me start with you. What do you make of this? There's this feeling, I guess, among some people that, you know, the ANC is really seeing the culmination of several crises come to bear at the same time and its effect on their electoral support. And now the party is, for the first time in a while, looking around for new ideas or new solutions to problems. Is that what's going on, or do you take the more cynical view? What do you think of this?
So, yeah, I do think, as you're speaking on crises, is that we're finally now seeing what occurs when you are too busy, you know, trying to fill race quotas, trying to give out rather suspect tenders out to certain people. And I think when we advocate for people to be appointed and, you know, chosen based on merit and skills and not just based on race, Eskom is currently the perfect example for us to use. I mean, they've used it for the longest time to fill quotas, and now they have a skills shortage, desperate, running to Solidarity. But I would caution, though, that, I mean, as admirable and respectable as Solidarity's offer is to, you know, provide skilled personnel and so forth, for the immediate crisis, I don't think this is a solution for the long term, because this only gives Eskom a longer lifeline. And we know that... this solution takes away from a bigger problem, because we don't need more of Eskom, you know, to be a corrupt pit, but we actually need more alternatives. We need the energy market essentially to be opened up. We need more independent power producers, because or else the situation will be where we prolong Eskom's monopoly. And that will just be kicking the can down the road.
Herman, what do you make of the central question of whether, you know, there really are new ideas coming into government now?
It's not the case. I think this is performative at best. A list of similar number of experts were sent by Solidarity to Pravin Gordhan in 2019, 3 years ago, and absolutely nothing happened. This is, I think, a bit of a stretch to think that there's some humbling going on here for two reasons. Number one, Nick, as you pointed out, that if you actually read the article, the headline is very, very misleading, and the presentation of the story is quite misleading. It is not a case of Gordhan being, you know, having this lucidum intervallum, this moment of clarity, going, "Oh my word, I need skills. Where can I find skills? Ah, Solidarity. They seems to be, you know, a skills hub." No, it's essentially that Solidarity has over the past few years been writing to the public works.
In May of 2019, they specifically provided a list of 700 people who they said.
Nothing came of it. So it is the continuation of this offer of solidarity to help, and I think it's an overly charitable and overly optimistic reading of the letters to go, this is Pravin, you know, willing to humble himself and go externally for skills. This is essentially him saying, you know that list that you sent me a few years ago, I don't know where it is. Could you perhaps send it to me again? Because this time I will do equally nothing with it. So I think it is performative, and it is part of a broader entitlement ideology that undergirds the National Democratic Revolution. You see this every time that Bladen Zimanda opens his mouth and speaks about a so-called investment strike. You know, this idea that the state is entitled, the government is entitled to the support and collaboration of the private sector. It is the state's and the government's place to demand such. And that support should not come in the form of some sort of market solution where private sector actors can benefit from it. At best, they won't be disadvantaged from it. But there's this entitlement idea, same with prescribed assets now being put back on the table by the SACP. There is this idea that government can expect, like a king, can expect the sort of acquiescence of the aristocracy. Government can expect the acquiescence and cooperation of the private sector. When the government, the king, calls the bannerman to himself, it is their duty to respond. This is very much baked into the National Democratic Revolution ideology. So I wouldn't get too excited about this. And I think the newspaper, News 24 headline is nothing but a desperate attempt to see hope in a rather hopeless situation where you've got a communist in charge of the government's SOEs, unwilling to acknowledge what has fundamentally gone wrong.
Yeah, so I think there's a great point to be picked up on there, which is that we've seen this thing sometimes when the ANC runs into trouble that and it starts to come under fire from big business and the private sector, which are generally not, you know, the bravest sorts in opposing bad government policy, at least publicly. But, you know, when they do start to kind of break their silence and go at the government publicly, the government often is very good at sort of bringing them inside the tent, so to speak, and making them feel special. And I get the feeling that that's sort of what's going on here. They're sort of saying, oh, Solidarity, you need to come inside the tent here. You need to give us these names. And then they basically co-opt you, so you're part of the process. It's just like, I think what happened to so many media figures in South Africa is, in exchange for access, you know, you'd get that exclusive interview with senior ANC members. And then you would essentially slowly be turned into a conduit for their point of view, not wittingly, but sort of unwittingly. You say, well, you know, this is what my inside sources are telling me.
And I do think that there are a few place that we can recognize from the ANC's political history in the last 30 years of how this is could be very similar to one of two instances, actually one of three instances. Number one, I think it was the late 90s or very early 2000s, the ANC government was immensely aggressive towards NGOs. So we know there are there is now again this simmering distaste and animosity, perhaps most tellingly exposed by Aaron Motsoaledi's criticism of the Helen Suzman Foundation. So number one, government is not positively disposed to the NGO sector. That's something that needs to be kept in mind. Number two, this is, Nick, exactly to your point of co-opting opposition into the larger whole. The government of national unity destroyed the National Party as a serious force in South African politics, even though under de Klerk, you know, post-1990, it was still the National Party, don't get me wrong, but its policy program wasn't awful. It did some good stuff. For example, the decentralization of the prosecuting authorities was an NP idea that the ANC then turned around. So there was some good stuff in the NP early 90s, you know, between 90 and once de Klerk came to power. And then the NP was co-opted into the Government of National Unity, so to the IFP. And in one foul swoop, the most potent opponents of the ANC were emasculated. This was also done with a mining charter, where an industrial commercial sector was emasculated similarly. So if they are antagonistic, we know they are antagonistic to the NGO sector, and we know they have the stunt to pull of taking critics outside the tent and getting them into the tent. Then the other thing is we shouldn't be cynical nor naive about the ability of the ANC to poison narratives in their ideological favor. In the years preceding the expropriation without compensation push, farmers were targeted in very subtle ways to be portrayed as villains. And this could really well be another instance of the ANC laying the groundwork for a sort of villainization of some of its critics, to say that we invited you to help us, then one of two things can happen. You came, you tried to help us, and the problem isn't solved. Hence, your solutions can never be listened to again. Or you came to help us, you didn't want to help. We invited you to help us, you didn't want to help us. Look, you're not honest brokers or not honest engagers here. Be very, very careful. This is an ideological movement that knows how to take out ideological opponents.
I think another great example of that is, and I think this has been talked about by Tony Leon, the former leader of the DA/DP, who in 1994 got invited into the Government of National Unity by Nelson Mandela. And he considered it, but he in the end said, no, we need to sort of sit outside as a opposition party, because he feared exactly what you just described happening to the DP. And as it turned out, he was probably correct. If he had gone into that government, the DP would have become completely irrelevant, because it would have been the smallest party by far in that Government of National Unity, with only, you know, just under 2% of the vote. And today, the DP/DA is the largest opposition party in the country. So it shows that one should be very cautious about collaborating in government if it's, you know, not necessarily an offer being made in good faith. Sholin, any final thoughts from you on this?
Yeah, no, I can definitely just agree. One of the comments really caught my eye, which was a line by Sisley, Big Daddy Liberty, which said, never trust a commie. And I think that's exactly the case and the caution that solidarity should enter into regarding the situation. Yeah, because or else they will just be painted with the same brush that everybody already paints the ANC with. And that would be very unfortunate.
Right. They mustn't make the mistake that so many organizations do when they enter into a compact like this, is sort of not wanting to scuttle the process. So you hold back on your criticism when things start going wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, but anyway, let's see. Maybe some good will come of this. I'm sure if some of the offer is taken up, it will not be a terrible thing, at least in the short term. Be nice to have some power. All right, let us move on to our next story. And this is about a government project that really should be more controversial. If you just take away the racial aspects of this program, it's kind of obviously controversial, right? Imagine there was a country out there that said, here's our plan. We're going to create a group of 100 or maybe 1,000 millionaires. If you did that in America, Bernie Sanders would never stop talking about it every day from the floor of Congress. But in South Africa, we have that program, but we just insert a little bit of race politics in there and it becomes not anything that anyone gets too worked up about. And this, of course, is the Black Industrialists Project, which is interpreted generously as an attempt to create new businesses to feed the South African economy, and is interpreted perhaps cynically as an attempt to feed cronies huge amounts of state funding for the purposes of advancing the National Democratic Revolution. So President Ramaphosa was recently been speaking about this program, and he said that up to 1,000 black business owners had benefited from the Black Industrialists and Exporters Initiative set up by government in 2015. This includes support from the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, as well as the Industrial Development Corporation and National Empowerment Fund. And the program's stated intention is to ensure greater inclusion and diversity in the economy. And at the initiative's inaugural conference in Sandton, Ramaphosa said that government had spent 55 billion rand in programs to support black enterprises, and that this was not Mickey Mouse money, this was serious investment. So one of our colleagues I think it was a year or two ago, read a Department of Trade and Industry report into the effects of this program. And what he noted was that the report was not very thick on details about, for example, how much tax revenue had been generated from these new businesses, how many jobs had been created, you know, the things that we do actually need. And instead, it mostly seemed to be focused on how much money had been spent on these programs. Herman, what do you make of this?
Well, beyond the obvious, it's a blatantly racist policy. It is quite spectacular how, if you read the coverage about this, they say they've spent 55 billion rand, and they are close to creating 1,000 black industrial millionaires. So I just quickly want to use my calculator here. So a billion has 9 zeros. If you take 55 billion rand and you just divide it by 1,000, don't do anything. Just gather the money and give it to someone else. Then you would have by now created 1,000 millionaires worth, what's it, 55 million each, somewhere along those lines. I might be terribly wrong. Math has never been my strong suit. But the point is, it sort of reminds of Reagan's test that if you take all the welfare in his, Time for Choosing speech, spectacular speech, go watch it. And if you take all the money spent on social security and support for the poorest, and you take all that money that goes to unemployment benefits, you could actually send every unemployed person to Harvard. And then he, of course, says not that Harvard is the solution to America's socioeconomic problems. But the long and short of it is a spectacular brag. It is a spectacular brag to say that we've spent 55 billion rand and we have almost created 1,000 millionaires. That is spectacular. Spectacularly useless. I mean, that is really, 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 really bad. That's not going into the fact that is an awful measurement for the success of what is supposed to be an economically beneficial program. Again, like you say, no investigation as to job creation. Was it a success in terms of job creation? That's not a metric they consider serious. Was it a success in creating expanding a middle class or a high middle class tax base? No, that's not a measurement for success. Has it boosted productivity locally? Has it boosted the service sector? No serious consideration of whether it has been an economic success. it's only, you know, how much money have they spent on it? And by that consideration alone, South Africa should be immensely proud of our education system and healthcare system, because we spend, you know, 200 billion rand a year on these industries. Never mind the results. But we spend. Oh, do we spend?
Right. If you subsidized, I don't know, the keyboard manufacturing industry with an enormous amount of money, and then didn't bother to measure how many keyboards had actually been produced by said industry, people would laugh you out of the room. But we're taking the same approach, it seems, here to, you know, it's not clear that any of this is anything other than a sort of elaborate patronage handout, rather than where's the evidence that there are sustainable businesses, jobs, anything being created here?
And the thing is that Mbeki was quite right in the, you know, sort of conservative economic policy that you need a strong middle class. And everyone agrees with that. And to build a manufacturing industrialist black middle class is, of course, something to aspire to. Yeah. But you don't do it through this type of nonsense. So when we're criticizing this policy, we're not criticizing the ambition. We're just saying that let's stick to the basic idea that Milton Friedman set out, is that you measure policies on their outcomes and not on their intentions. There are ways to create a black middle class. We've seen it happen in South Africa. In fact, the black middle class expanded and then started contracting again in the last few years. There are examples where you take where the middle class can be grown. Thatcher shows it. Lee Kuan Yew certainly shows it. I mean, rather controversially, Pinochet shows it. The ability to grow the middle class has economic ammunition, but this type of top-down, pick a few winners, randomly, arbitrarily measure by billions spent and by millionaires created, I mean, it's just an economically moronic way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Charlene, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do think, like, we have seen, you know, where people have directed money to just a small elite or connected minority of people. And we've seen it before in this country. And that's exactly what occurred during apartheid. And we now actually literally see that the ANC, the freedom fighters, have literally now become the very racist and targeting a specific racial group. Just like the former adversaries did not so long ago. And
right. That argument is often made explicit in a lot of ANC stuff. They say, well, you know, the Afrikaner state created all of these patronage positions for Afrikaners, and therefore we must do the same thing for Black Africans, not recognizing perhaps some of the problems there.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I should add there, Nick, that when they refer to Black Africans, it needs to be somebody that is obviously connected to the ANC and who has favorable views of the party, because they bragging about making 1,000 Black Africans millionaires. But in the reality that we know is that we see record unemployment in the country. We see immense amounts of inequality and a poor education system, which is causing the millions of Black South Africans, South Africans overall, to be stuck in poverty and actually struggling financially. But yet they are patting themselves on the back that they have, you know, executed their patronage network perfectly. So whoever the marketing team is behind this and coining the term Black industrialist, brilliant marketing, but in reality we know that it means absolutely nothing.
You know, I just try to imagine this on the campaign trail. You know, you're sitting there in your shack, you know, you've had pup today, yeah. It's the only meal you've had. You're turning down the paraffin in your lamp because you're just hoping that it can last you for the whole night. And then that ANC pamphlet is pushed through the door and it says, look, you may be living in a shack, but did you know that there's a person with the same skin color out there who's a millionaire who wasn't a millionaire yesterday? It's like, oh, that's absolutely— okay.
And the real, you know, technical vacuum where this policy's heart should be, is that it has no value add consideration. Mm. It is just redistributive, and the problem is it is destructively so. Now, there are measures of redistribution that I think we can all agree with. But the fact is that there was no value add here. Just like BEE, it is not, it is the policy, people who allow the policy to be measured by its intentions perpetuate the sort of nonsense that we see here. If we are going to have policies that say, right, we need to take poor people and create a middle class, then we can say, right, so the measurements of this should be economically sound. It should be about productivity. It should be about value add. It should be about tax contributions expanding. It should be about job creation. It should be about attracting international or even local investment. Those are sensible measurements. But the absurdity we see here is the government just going, oh, we spent so much. We have spent so much. We are, oh.
We're super serious about this, guys. We promise. Yeah. We spent so much money.
Yeah, Nick, I just wanted to mention, now we're actually seeing a situation where even they are now considering, you know, increasing the welfare grant, 350 Rand welfare grant, to 650 Rand, which is an absolutely ridiculous thing, considering the fact that you guys are on the one hand giving the giving millions to certain to a minority, while you guys think that the rest of the actually struggling poor are worth 650 Rand. So they really are not even consistent on that basis.
All right, let us move, because we are running out of time now, to our last topic. And I know, Herman, you have things to say about this, so I think we're just going to give the floor to you. And that is the UK's leadership race, the race to be the next prime minister after Boris Johnson when he steps down, presumably in September. And we're now down to a final two candidates amongst the Conservative Party's options. So, Herman, would you like to tell us very briefly about the two candidates?
Yeah, so essentially how it works is that the Conservative Party in Parliament is responsible for nominating from its membership a few candidates stand for the leadership, and then there's this whittling down until you've reached the final two. Once you've got the final two, they are then sent on a series of hustings, campaign events, where they set out their stall and try to convince the membership of the Conservative Party, of which are about 180,000 in the UK. And these people then decide who the leader of the party would be. And the idea behind the mechanism is okay, that you need at least a candidate where the parliamentary party can work with them as caucus leader, and then the party and the country as a whole need to have a say. So you can't just have a Westminster stitch-up, because then you go back to the 19th century, but you can't just have a situation where the membership determines all, because then you're in a Jeremy Corbyn situation where 70% plus of his parliamentary caucus had no confidence in him, but they couldn't get rid of him, so they had to follow his lead. So it's a relatively okay system. These two candidates are now Rishi Sunak, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Liz Truss, current Foreign Secretary. Labour is always the party that pats itself on the back for its diversity push. It is the party of all women shortlist and all racial minority shortlists for some seats. And the Conservative Party have toyed with these things but never actually implemented them. And yet the Conservative Party will now be either on its third women leader after Thatcher, May, and possibly then Liz Truss, or its first ethnic minority in Rishi Sunak. So there's a slight little satisfactory stab that meritocracy, if you want true diversity of identity, if that's something that, you know, makes your heart beat faster, not particularly in my case the case, but if that is your spiel, then meritocracy might be your swiftest way to a sort of ethnically, racially diverse place, because surprise, surprise, people's competence to do jobs have very, very little to do with the color of their skin. What is the contest now about? It is essentially Liz Truss, very much a Reaganite, Rishi Sunak, very much a Thatcherite, in the sense that Sunak is more about fiscal conservatism, getting the state's finances under control, tackling inflation through that measure, where Liz Truss is very much more, right, it's now a good time to borrow money, so that with rates being as they are, let's incur debt now It's a good time to incur debt so that we can ease the taxation burden and cut billions of pounds of taxation. I'm actually very skeptical of that second approach. I fear it might unleash further inflationary pressures, because if we're going to go with a traditional definition of inflation being too much money chasing too few goods, unleashing more money into the system without either a review of the Bank of England's monetary policy or a large-scale reduction in state expenditure, you are just adding more money to the fire. So by the 5th of September, after about 14 hustings events across the country, the Conservative Party members will elect the next leader of the Conservative Party, who will then become Prime Minister on likely the 5th of September. So it's an open race. Sunak is at this stage the underdog. Truss is more popular with the members. But it's early days. It's early days, and Sunak has proven himself to be an effective campaigner, and Truss less so.
Yes, very interesting to watch. Anyway, we are out of time. So thank you very much to both of you, and thank you everyone for listening and watching. We hope that you enjoyed, and we will see you next week on The Daily Friend Show. I hope you all have a most excellent, wonderful, and fantastic weekend. And cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.